Blog Talk Radio.
Metsville and baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael LeColant, also known as the Brooklyn Trolley Blogger, and I welcome you back to the Metsian Podcast. Tis the season. Happy holidays to all. As we enter COVID winter number three, may they be merry as possible. And a belated happy winter solstice. For those not paying attention, if you look into the southern sky on a clear night, still you'll catch Venus, Saturn, and Jupiter in the same night sky. Don't let it pass. You only have the rest of the month to observe it. So that being said, it's showtime. The buck stops in Flushing. Whatever way you choose to amuse yourself with that, the Mets have a new manager. We're going to talk about that. But first, on behalf of my partners, I would like to say hello and welcome back to New York City to Angela Showalter, who the general media essentially ignored for over an hour of questioning with Buck. Shame on them. They all deserve a brick of coal in their stocking come in a few days. It wasn't until SNY took over, and even then, Gary Apple, two questions, nothing. It wasn't until Andy Martino, who was such a target on Twitter, kudos to him for finally breaking through and engaging her in conversation. All that being said, let's jump in. Let me bring my partners in. I'm jumping off my soapbox, and we'll start talking Mets baseball. Hailing from Connecticut, my fellow ailing Giant football fan, Rich Sparago. Hello. Hello, my friend.
Mike, happy holidays to you, to Sam, and to all the listeners, and hello to you, sir. Yeah, the Giants, I don't know what more there's left to say about that, but except do we really, really have to see more of Glennon? But I guess that's a topic for maybe a Giants podcast. But anyway, anybody but Glennon, please. But no, I'm very, very excited to talk Buck Showalter. I was telling you before we went on the air, I literally just walked in the door, so I did not see any of his introductory press conference today. So I'm looking forward to catching dribs and drabs of that in the news later. But I'm certain we'll have a lot to talk about. So very much looking forward to it.
And then we have the Nomad, hailing from parts metropolitan area, the president of the Metsian Podcast, Sam Maxwell. Everyone, Sam, how are you?
Michael Collant, Rich Sparago, thank you for welcoming me. The Metsian Podcast does wish everyone out there I hope you have a very Jewish Christmas. I wish you a merry belated Hanukkah and a happy new year to everyone involved. That's the best I can do as a half Jew myself by birth. So, you know, that's the best way that I can phrase it. I think it's all merged together. And Mike, I'm so happy you first mentioned Angela. Because what was so amazing about the press conference, and Rich, you said you didn't watch it, was that it reminded me from a frame perspective of all of the couple sides of Harry Met Sally, and one in particular where the husband, like the woman, just looked like she had a very stoic face and didn't you know change her expression, but occasionally she would correct in a good way, welcomed by the husband. He would go to her and, was it Carol or Sally? And she would go, Sally. or something like that. And it's something like that. It reminded me of some of those vignettes from Harry Met Sally, just the framing of Buck and Angela. And I'm looking forward to knowing more about this fantastic couple. I can't wait to talk more about this press conference.
In the interest of fairness, throughout that hour, I think there were maybe two people who acknowledged her. One of them I know was Otis Livingston of WCBS Channel 2. The other one, I'm not so sure. Otherwise, nothing. Silence. Crickets. Unbelievable. Rich, jump in.
Well, I saw a little bit about that, about how, you know, she went basically unacknowledged and looked bored, but I haven't witnessed it firsthand. So, you know, but just to jump in on Buck, if I may, you know, I don't know how, I'm sure that we're going to be getting to this in a moment, but I'm thrilled to have Buck as the manager of the Mets, and I think most of Mets world is. I think I've seldom seen the media, the you know, the fans so aligned around a choice. Now, granted, you have some people who, a few outliers who point to the fact that he's in his 60s and it's an analytically driven game now, and you know, and he might not have been the right choice for that reason. But generally speaking, it's pretty rare when Mets Twitterville is aligned and Mets fans are aligned on anything, and they're pretty much aligned on this one. You know, that this is a good choice, and I'm with it. You know, I believe that that Buck's a great choice. I can't wait to see the press conference, or at least, you know, the pieces of it that I'll see, probably on Sports Night and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I'll start with. I'll start with my impressions of the hire. I think it's perfect for all the reasons most have talked about. You know, it's a win-now team. You have a guy who's a veteran manager, not learning on the job like the last two managers were. And I think it just, the selection of manager is in keeping with the theme that the team is putting out there now. We want to win now. We're spending money now. It just all seems to flow. And gentlemen, I'll leave you with this thought on this question is, when was the last time you're able to say that those two things? Most people, media and fans alike, think the Mets are doing the right thing. And the Mets are actually, you know, spending the money and the plan is there. You could see it. It's palpable. And dare I say the word that they just seem like they're competent now. And that's fantastic.
This is definitely going to go two or three rounds because there's so much to cover. thank you to Adam Spiegel for always setting our mood with our 80s inspired opening tune. Thank you to him. And, you know, setting the mood. The mood in Flushing has suddenly changed, Sam. We have Buck Showalter, and, you know, he's no rookie. And that's what we're transitioning away from. Again, there's a lot to, you know, for us to get off our chests and to applaud and things of that nature. We'll make a couple of passes on this. So what are your opening impressions?
The easiness about him, you know, other than the fact that, like, he's been media coached, but maybe the reason why he was so well suited for the media role that he has chosen over the last few years was because he was already really he started with George Steinbrenner and the New York Yankees. Let's start there. Obviously, that's what you think about it, slightly coming full circle, almost the opposite of a Casey Stengel or the opposite of a Joe Torre. Hopefully that would be lovely. Right. And how humorous he was just every single time. And just like, you're getting me carried away. What was the other question? You know, like all these different things, Rich, I wish you had seen some of it because I was thinking about the managers and I was thinking about, and I think we're not going to go, I guess let's go all the way to Davey onward, and I don't want to – some of these guys I haven't analyzed from a humorous perspective, but for one thing, Dallas Green seems to not only be outspoken but also in a humorous way occasionally, even if he had some odd success, some odd non-success here, excuse me. But it seems as if Dallas Green is not hated as much amongst the 90s guys, because he just it just kind of happened that way for somebody who brought the Phillies their first world championship. Bobby Valentine obviously had such a sense of humor and understood how to interact with the media. Then I think about Art Howe. Didn't seem to work in that same type of favor. I don't remember him having much humor, and I'm sure other people can chime in on that one way or another better than I can, because it's a little pre the Big Bang from a Metsian perspective for me. But when it comes to Willie Randolph, Jerry Manuel, Terry Collins, they all had so much more humor and effervescence when it came to interacting with the media, as much especially with all three of those names that I uttered that we've had issues with. Plenty. But, like, I understand what I liked about Terry at the time, and I understood what I didn't like. And I still will to this day say with Terry that what I didn't like unfortunately prevented us from winning a World Series. But I just have this really good feeling about the convergence of these two paths, the Metsian path and the Bucksian path. And I think it's a match made in heaven. And Rich, I definitely advise you to watch the entire, you know, I watched the SNY, so it was probably I guess it was probably an hour or so, maybe 45 minutes to an hour. But I advise you to watch the whole thing. I advise everybody to watch the whole thing.
Buck Showalter, well, he's the guy I wanted. You know, what went on last season, insofar as the locker room and player shenanigans, didn't sit well with me because of the manager, because the manager didn't control the narrative. There was a lot of times when, you know, the former manager was left speechless. He didn't know what to say. I don't mean that. I'm not casting blame. I'm just saying that the command and the control of the narrative was not there. And far too often, you know, we were being led down the rabbit hole by the players themselves. And I think Buck comes in and changes that. This is a transitioning team. There's, you know, it's a veteran-laden team now. Dom Smith has time. Nimmo has time. You know, so point to the rookies on the team and count them. They're not many. So this is a veteran team. I think Buck is the right guy for the right time. And we'll discuss the future later on in the show. But for right now, I think he's the right person. I do think he's very adaptable. Sam, to your point, you know, Buck's past, I think he was majorly screwed over by the Yankees after the 1995 season. So I've always had respect for Buck Showalter, and he's a man who commands respect. And I guess that's a little bit of my military background, because I see structure, and where I see structure, I see effectiveness. And the Mets kind of lost their way. You know, athletes are athletes, players are players, but sometimes they need to be kept on the straight and narrow. And you don't have to be a dictator to get that done. You know, would you rather be feared or would you rather be respected? You know, that's the age-old debate. So Buck commands a lot of respect. And I'm not trying to dance around the phrase, you know, clubhouse culture. No. I'm just saying that Buck is going to keep these guys accountable and make sure their noses are to the grindstone insofar as conducting their you know, preparations correctly and execution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think he's completely adaptable to new modern information. I think he'll be very adept at it. You know, I don't see his age as a shortcoming. I see experience his major asset. So, you know, again, we'll talk about the future, but for right now, and for his 3 years here, I think he's the right guy, and he's the guy I wanted all along. I'm not against resume guys like the former Met manager. I'm not against that. You know, I'm a proponent of that. At some point, somebody needs a break. Somebody always starts somewhere. You know, and that's something that Buck alluded to in the press conference. He says, hey, once upon a time, somebody cut me a break, hired me. And, you know, here we are all this time later. So I'm happy, and I'm going to throw it around the room again. And, Rich, I'll cycle back to you, Buck Showalter, the new manager of the New York Metropolitan Baseball Club.
Well, you know, Mike, I've given this a lot of thought, and let me just kind of lay out where I am with it, why I think it's a good choice. When you think about what you're asking a manager day and age, you're asking the manager to in-game decisions, and we'll talk about that in a second. Oh, let's talk about that now. So for in-game decisions, that's where the analytics come in. You know, Terry Collins says, I was never given a lineup. Okay, maybe literally you were not, but let's face it, every front office, the Mets have bulked up their analytics group, every front office is having heavy, heavy influence in the lineup. Further to that point, when things are happening in-game, the manager has been given the analytics on, okay, so let's just say your situational lefty last year was Aaron Loop. The manager knows going into the game that Loop cannot get this guy out, but he can get these three guys out. You know, historically, he does very well against those guys. So all of that, the manager isn't managing by feel anymore. A lot of what's happening in the game is pre-scripted by the analytics, or at least heavily informed. Now, counter to that, I was thinking about the game against the Cardinals this year at Citi Field late, you know, mid-September, when the Mets basically needed to win every game. If you remember this game, the second game of the series, they got blown out in the first game. In the second game, Javi tied it with a home run in the bottom of the ninth. Bottom of the tenth, the Mets got the first two guys on, and James McCann came up. And everybody on Twitter was blowing up, should we have him bunt? Should he swing away? You know, he only bunted twice. No, that's a decision the manager probably has to make based on feel a little bit. Yes, the analytics probably inform that too. But what I'm saying is the in-game decisions the manager has to make are pretty much coming from the analytics that he is given. Okay, it's not a gut feel like it was with Earl Weaver, you know, back in the 60s. So in terms of making those in-game decisions, how much discretion does the manager have? I'm going to say it's fairly limited. Then the other part of what you're asking a manager to do, you're asking a manager to lead a clubhouse of 25 guys who come from different cultures. Some are rookies, some are veterans, all those things. Be a leader of men. That's what the Mets bought with Buck Showalter. I think a lot of the decisions that are made these days can be made by anyone because they're informed by the front office, by the analytics. And most of them, not all decisions, but a large portion of them. But managing that clubhouse, managing those personalities, keeping those guys, like you talked about the rat raccoon thing or whatever, you know, story you were referring to, there are many where the clubhouse got away from them last year. That's the kind of stuff that the manager really has to do still is be a leader of men and deal with that kind of thing. And that to me is why Buck Showalter is the right man, not because of in-game decision-making, but because of his experience in being a clubhouse leader, being, you know, and what he brings to the table in that regard. That's how I see it. I don't really think these days you're hiring a manager for in-game expertise. You're hiring the manager more for what that manager does in front of the press, in front of the guys in the clubhouse, and I think they have an incredible winner in that way, and that's exactly what they need in Buck Showalter. And then finally, I'll quote something I saw on Baseball Night in New York, which a lot of people have said. They said, you know, when people say, oh, Buck's, you know, in his mid-60s and he doesn't know analytics and things like that, they said, hold on a second. And this is what I felt from the beginning. You're not asking this guy or any manager to sit there with an Excel spreadsheet and pop in numbers and write formulas. That's what the analytics group does. You're handing the person, you pay these analytics people to hand the manager understandable chunks of information to inform decision making. He's not pulling analytics and trying to figure out the OPS formula. That's what those guys do. He's being given basically a script to work from. And that is an important point here, and people say that because he's 65, or I think he's 65, he can't handle the analytics, because I was so thankful when they said this last night. He's not being asked to do analytics. He's being asked to implement them. Those are two enormously different things. So that's my soapbox.
Well said, Rich. And, you know, you brought up a key element, which to me is the press. Sam, he knows the lay of the land.
Well, one of the – another thing from the press conference is, you know, and it dawned on me as he was joking around, but Joel Sherman asked a question, and I think – maybe I missed it, but I guess the I wish I knew the press guy's name now, the main guy who is divvying it up for the Mets right now, basically taking over for Jay Horowitz. When Joel Sherman came in, Buck said something on the thing about how he's just like Adele or Madonna. It's just Joel. it just cracked me up. And it dawned on me that, like, they literally had just been working with each other on MLB. And do any of you know, Rich, have you been watching Major League Baseball Network the last few weeks or at all?
Yeah, I've watched it. I've seen Buck in the studio. He's fantastic.
So when did he stop coming into the studio over the last few weeks?
That I don't know off the top of my head.
Because he was chiming in on Billy Epler, and that clip was getting passed around Twitter of him talking about the Mets fan and what they want out of the general manager and the people running things. He was basically, you know, probably, you know, we don't know the inner machinations of both baseball and the network, but I'm sure he may have been well aware he was going to be considered, and people are watching. So there, and Joel Sherman, who was still skeptical at the time, had some skeptical things to say. But you know, Buck was, you know, it dawned on me that clip basically. And so, yeah, in terms of knowing the lay of the land, right there is a perfect example, and he handled it beautifully.
Well said. So, you know, unless you have any other observations, any opinions about the coaching staff? We know Jeremy Hefner will remain on as pitching coach. Otherwise, you know, a lot of positions to fill. Anybody on the
I'll just start with the Jeremy Hefner part in that Buck addressed that he can't wait to get back on the phone with him. And I think I've been talking with some people, other Mets fans, that I think that anybody who had an issue with setting any kind of coaching staff, it looks like, appropriately so, Jeremy Hefner was the exception. I mean, they brought him in he was 33 years of age last year. Why would you get rid of a 33-year-old man, pitching coach, when that was not the problem with the team last year? And we've addressed the problems with the team, and it seems everybody is addressing it on a clubhouse perspective, considering they did something unprecedented, which was be the longest team in first place and finish with a losing record. So I think everybody understands, and something else that I'll bring up from the clubhouse, and I'll let you go off of this, Mike, however you want to, that Buck said something about you know, and they couldn't name players because of lockout, but and why would he do this in this particular perspective? But he said something about subtraction without adding. Like, and it, I don't know whether it was a little bit of shade to not bring Stroman back, but if you guys go to that part of press conference, I was wondering about that when he said stuff about addition by subtraction. He said something like addition by subtraction. I was wondering if it was Stroman related.
I don't think so, but that went over my head. I didn't make much of it. Perhaps I heard that with one ear. But, you know, sometimes, look, in these pressers, you're forced to talk, and you're forced to talk too long. And sometimes you need to be creative in what you say and continue and answer and answer and answer. So sometimes, you know, it's like a hamster wheel. It has to stop at some point. And I try not to place too much importance in these pressers. I hear what I want to hear. The rest to me is just, a dog and pony show. You know, the media getting theirs and, you know, the organization putting out their new guy. It's all very contrived. So I don't place too much importance on stuff like that and so much as what they say. We know Buck. You know, and if you want to bring in the general manager who made the ultimate decision to hire him, again, we talked about some of the off-season acquisitions, and we talked about the players themselves, but I said, well, you know, the onus is on the general manager. He hired them. He's paying them. Now they have to produce, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And here's another circumstance where he's hiring an experienced guy. So let's transition to what we or how we see the next 3 years unfolding. Like I said, we can no longer be considered as a young based team. These guys have years under their belts now. They're not, some of you know these players that I'm talking about aren't free agent eligible yet, but that day is coming soon. So this is a very transitionary team. A very transient team that I expect to be wholly, wholly different. I expect a whole new Lance 3 years from now. But let's stick with these next 3 years, and we'll call them the Buck years. How do you envision these years unfolding? I'll start with Mr. Cohen, our new owner, must continue supporting and propping this team up financially until they get the minor league machine purring like a kitten again. Once you do that and you promote talent, you know, you can scale back the spending and now rely on your youth, you know, and spend your money more wisely in other departments, et cetera, et cetera. But for the very short term, and this is what I've been, you know, hammering home all off season is that Mr. Cohen's money needs to support and prop this team up in the now. And what do I mean by the now? The upcoming season, the season after that, and maybe even that third season out. So the next 3 years, what does your crystal ball say, Rich?
Well, that's a great question. You know, and I'll start with a question back, then I'll answer it. The question back would be something I saw on Baseball Night in New York, where the question asked of the panel was, "What the Mets have spent a ton of money on Scherzer. They brought in Buck, and they brought in the three players they signed earlier, Marte, Canna, and Escobar. And so, what would be success over the next 3 years? How would you define it? You know, based on this. And so, but to answer your question, the next 3 years, what I see happening is more of the same, Mike. I think you nailed it a couple of podcasts ago. When you said right now the only currency the Mets have, no pun intended, is money. You know, they don't have young talent to trade for veterans. They don't have the ability to do that. So what I think you'll see is you'll see Mr. Cohen opening his checkbook quite a bit, and I think you'll see if they're in the hunt in the middle of the season, and God only hope they are, right? I think you'll see no hesitation to add, to spend money to add. Next season, the farm system still is not going to be ready, so they will build it. They will continue to build the team on the premise of using Cohen's money. And so I do think that's what will happen. I think you'll see more of that until you get some equilibrium, until you get to a point where the farm season, you know, the Vientos of the world and the Mangum of the world, or those guys are ready to go. Maybe they get a chance to restock some more. So I think you're going to see a team that might look a bit like the Yankees used to, you know, back in the old days when the Yankees would basically just have diarrhea of the wallet. I think you'll see that over the next couple of seasons until you can hit that point where you have some other capital that you could use in terms of young talent that you can either supplement with or trade. So then, but now I'm going to answer that question I asked you guys, which is, what is realistic to expect over the next few years? And I'm going to answer it by saying, based on the investment they've made and based on the investment they probably will continue to make for the reasons that we've just talked about, if they don't win a World Series in the next 3 years, I don't think it's a success. I don't think so. You know, the answers I heard of the panel, you know, somebody said, well, at least a World Series appearance. No. They've spent a ton of money. They brought in a veteran manager. I don't think he's stopping with the money. I think, you know, he said 3 to 5 years to win a World Series. Now, based on where we are now and where the trajectory is going, if they don't win a World Series in the next 3 to 5 years, I think it would be a disappointment. That's where I am with it.
Sam, wherever you want to go.
Yeah, no, I think they definitely need to win a World Series. It would be nice. Buck even said it was just like the idea is to win multiple ones. But, and I also want to, I don't want to necessarily predict, you know, I've mentioned on this podcast, I've mentioned before, I just, these prediction things, even when they try to predict the record to the T, it doesn't make any sense to me. However, I will say that the World Series or bust is evident and obvious. However, something that I will take away from this press conference to bounce off of what you finished with on the last part, Mike, was that difference between this press conference versus others was that it just felt more earned with all the stuff that was saying that could be considered cliche. And again, the convergence of times, I that's just how it feels. And that maybe I'm just going to get egg in my face, like all us Met fans do who are over confident and over obvious, but I'm not trying to be overconfident. I'm just trying overconfident and over optimistic. I meant, I'm not trying to be overconfident. I'm just trying to both analyze from a narrative perspective as well as the good feelings that we're building off of not only last year, trying to throw away the fact that we set something unprecedented and realize that that had to be done to still consider what was the beginning last year of the proper way of doing things. And look at even the clubhouse stuff that we're talking about and the rumors about it, regardless of the choking part with Francisco Lindor and Jeff McNeil. We're talking about the rumor being that Francisco Lindor didn't like that Jeff McNeil wasn't buying into what the team needed. That was the narrative, that he was pissed off that Jeff McNeil wasn't a team player. And whether or not that was all true, it sounds about right, weirdly enough. I'm not saying that Jeff McNeil doesn't want to win. Not saying that at all. But that I'm still looking at the overall macro as well as this micro going forward, and that's why I'm optimistic and confident that Buck Showalter will win at least one World Series with the Mets, if not more.
Perhaps I'm a little bit more forgiving than you guys. I will be content if we have consecutive playoff appearances. You know, if Steve Cohen pays for a World Series, hey, I'll be happy. No doubt about that. But I will be content with consecutive playoff appearances and opportunities to make it to the World Series. I don't know if that sounds funny coming from me, considering I said that with the new owner, I have new and different expectations. But, you know, I've already looked 3 years beyond. In 3 years from now, I want to be on the outskirts of a dynasty. That's my thought process. I want to build something. And, you know, you can't build it all in one day, as they said about a famous city. Now, outside of Lindor because of his contract, and maybe even Pete Alonso, outside of those two players, I don't foresee anybody on the present roster being a New York Met 3 years out, entering that fourth year from now. I foresee the Mets letting Dom Smith walk away, if not trading him, unless Brandon Nimmo can prove that he can stay healthy for an entire season. I think they let him walk away. You know, if Michael Conforto is any glimpse, and if we let history teach us, they're going to let these guys walk away. And, you know, I'm content with that because I want them to rebuild this core. This core had its time, didn't flourish very well. That's where my mind is. And I see, and, you know, I'll reiterate, I think these next 3 years, if they spend wisely and well, yeah, I'm all for that. I just think that Buck Showalter is the right guy to guide us through these next three transition years. But, you know, four years from now, I want to be on the precipice of a dynasty. That's what I'm thinking. Built from the ground up. And this is on Billy Epler, if you want to take it from there, Rich.
Well, you know, ideally we do both, right, Mike? I mean, ideally the spending strategically produces a World Series in the next 3 years. Look, you know, I think this fan base desperately needs it. And again, as I said earlier, based on what he spent already and what I think he will continue to spend over the next couple of years, to get an ROI on that type of spend, I think that World Series needs to happen in the next 3 years. I don't think we need to wait or should have to wait 4, 5, 6 years to win the first one. But to your point, while all this is happening on the surface, maybe below the surface, they're drafting well. They're not trading prospects because they're using, you know, financial capital to bring players in. So while that's happening, maybe they're developing the talent like they had in the mid-'80s, you know, when they had, you know, maybe from like 83 through 86. They're stocking that farm system, to your point, it can be built, and maybe it doesn't have to be built exclusively on the premise of just outspending everybody. It could be built on the idea of doing both, you know, strategic spending, as well as supplementing, or even maybe the first line of defense, you know, to put a good team on the field becomes the system, and then you're supplementing, you're flipping the script a little bit and supplementing that with players brought in via money. So, yeah, I would love to see both, Mike. That's my short answer, as I would love to see a championship in the next 3 years while they have Scherzer, while hopefully they'll have DeGrom for those couple of years, win a championship now, all the while building for the future, because we all know that sustainable winning is the goal. Look, it's been 36 years. We would love to win a World Series now and worry about sustainability later. Absolutely. But sustainable winning has to be your goal, not a one-time championship. While that would be nice, right? But sustainable winning has to be the goal. And I think the two could work together.
You're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. So, Sam, you know, gonzo, freeform, What say you?
Oh, I mean, yeah. Just going off of that sustainable winning, that's all we've been looking for. And that is, I guess, in many ways what the Dodgers have been able to do because they've had the money to throw while developing and keeping those prospects or eventually trading like they did with, you know, some players, including Mookie Betts. So that is the way it begins, basically. And when you're talking about a dynasty, that's you know, it didn't happen for the Cubs. It didn't happen for the White Sox. But it, you could argue, definitely happened for the Red Sox. You know, they didn't group it together, but the fact that they've been able to win as many championships as they have since that first one in 2004 says as much that they've been able to exorcise their demons to the max. Patriots, another team from that time, you know, you go back and the Patriots are not even close to the way we think about them now. The Golden State Warriors, we all hate them now. At what point do we even consider them a thing to hate? So, and the funny thing is there's plenty of people, oddly enough, that hate the Mets, but even the ones who have rivals, like you talk to Philly fans sometimes, they're like, hey guys, listen, I really hope you get it together. Like, you know, like they understand what Mets fans, like more people relate to the Mets issue, you know, even if they kind of don't want to see them do well. You know, and have issues with their fans and yada yada. Everybody's got issues with everybody's fans. So, you know, yes, at some point we could exorcise those demons and be the hated dynasty. But, like, even then, I feel like even after three world championships in a row, even, like, the biggest Mets hater will be like, yeah, well, I think they deserved it after all that.
That's funny. So, Rich, Todd Zeal had something to say. Sure.
He did. Todd Zeal said, I believe it was late last week, that Marcus Stroman was a divisive force in the clubhouse. And I think he said definitely one of the more divisive players on the team, and that it's probably, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, that it's probably a good thing that Stroman is no longer here. But he was very direct in saying that, you know, that Stroman was a divisive force on the team. And so now I wonder, you know, obviously we're not in the clubhouse. We don't know. What we do know is Stroman is very outspoken. He believes what he believes, which is fine. He has a very strong personality, which is fine. But it makes you wonder because, you know, it didn't seem like the Mets, to my knowledge, put any kind of effort into trying to retain Marcus Stroman, not that I'm aware of. You didn't hear that the Mets were in any kind of a bidding war with the Cubs or that the Mets had, you know, put an offer on the table that Stroman declined or anything like that. So here's a guy, you know, who was an incredibly effective starting pitcher. And the Mets, who need starting pitching, made no apparent attempt to retain him. So you wonder if where there's smoke, there's fire. I'm not saying there is. I'm not there. I have no idea. But those are pretty damning comments to come from Todd Zeal, who, you know, working for SNY and you know, of course, the Wilpons no longer on the team, but SNY is very close to the team. I'm sure Zeal talks to a lot of people. And if you kind of do the math on this one, you know, you kind of get there. I mean, is this really true? You know, is it true that maybe the reason Stroman wasn't, no apparent attempt was made to retain him, could it be that he is a divisive force in the clubhouse or was? And I just want to know what you guys think of that.
Sam?
It's a difficult one because, you know, the guy blocked me, but I don't want, like, how do I know whether he just has a guy who blocks people just because, you know, like Sal blocked me. Sal Akata blocked me, but I said nothing derogatory about Sal. I just happened to be in a chain that somebody, like, I said something about, so I was, I said something against something that a caller said to Sal. And then somebody was like, well, who cares about, you know, that buffoon or something, because people give Sal crap on social media. And then all of a sudden I'm blocked, even though I didn't say anything derogatory about Sal. So I I'm not going to hold against Sal. I'm not going to hold against Marcus, that kind of stuff. And everybody has, you know, like, for one, let's go into this idea that Marcus Stroman likes a derogatory tweet about Anthony DeComo regarding his Italian heritage. And then when confronted about it, he said that people superimpose, you know, screenshots. And basically, it seemed in the exchange, and Rich, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here in what I understand about it, but Mark, Jesus, how am I forgetting his last name? Mark, he used to cover the Mets, and now he works for the Atlantic.
Works for the Atlantic.
Frick. Mark Carey. Right, okay, thank you. So he was just like, oh, are you going to say I was lying about this too? Or so, something like where basically he came back out and said, oh, you're saying I'm – like basically that he's the one who took the screenshot basically is the way Mark seemed to respond. And for one, yes, everybody should be aware of what they do. But like I know you got – like – you know how quick sometimes we like things? It seems as if we haven't liked anything derogatory yet. But again, I can't hold it against Marcus for potentially accidentally liking something that he immediately removed once he realized what he did. Like, we have to stop trying to cancel everybody. Just whether it's Todd Zeal. Like, now it becomes these sides, and everybody's just like, oh, well, you know, you're Wilpon-driven, and, you know, who's going to trust this? And people are going after Danny Abriano for going after it. And you know, but at the same time, Mark Healy has something to say about it, you know? And we love Mark Healy. And so, like, I'm just tired of having to pick sides. Aren't you guys tired of having to pick sides, whether it's with the Mets or otherwise?
Well, I mean, that's what they do. They churn the butter and smear us with their stuff. That's what the media does. Rich, in reaction to, you know, Zeal's comments and this matter of Marcus Stroman, single him out. There was a lot of weak links in the chain. Perhaps he was one of them, but there was certainly more. And if the incoming GM has other ideas, well, that's where I place the onus. And there's a new manager now. And I'm sure throughout this process, Sandy Alderson might have had something to say, a little bit of input. But I firmly believe that Billy Epler is in charge of making his own decisions. I'll believe that until proved otherwise. You know, Marcus Stroman, he was an interesting cat. I'll say that. I'm not going to get all wrapped up in, you know, social media. I mean, I'm just not going to go there. He was an odd cat. He was a self-promoter. And... like I say, there's little grains of truth in everything, pro, con, or otherwise. But, you know, if we say Marcus Stroman, I will point to Zach Wheeler. I think the Mets treated him quite badly in letting him just leave under no uncertain terms. You know, so there's a comparison there. And I guess, you know, this third man in, they have other ideas. I choose to think of it that way and go with the weak links, the multiple weak links in the chain theory. But very interesting and little grains of sand, you know. So I don't know what else to say. I see this team, you know, churning players. I think it's going to be somewhat unrecognizable from one season to the next. So let's see. Gentlemen, if you have any more outstanding matters, comments, rude remarks, or otherwise, I think that's a wrap. And we should start closing up shop for the holidays.
Well,
Rich,
I,
what say you?
I just wanted to touch upon Buck touched upon the possibility that there could be a shortened spring training. So I'll go to you first, Rich.
Well, it's definitely possible. You know, there's no sense of urgency. Let me give you an update because I'm covering this for Mesmerize. Let me give you an update as to where we are. The two sides met last Thursday for the first time since early December, but they've agreed actually not to talk about key economic issues until at least January. So they're talking about little stuff. Like, I shouldn't say little. I apologize for saying that. But one of the things they're talking about is drugs and domestic abuse stuff and how will they handle that when it occurs in baseball. So they're talking about non-core economic issues now. They're not even talking about the big stuff that's keeping them – and I mean big stuff in terms of divisively big, not big in terms of life big. So there's no sense of urgency yet because – really, February 1st is the date that everybody's circling, myself included, because if they don't have an agreement by February 1st, spring training will be delayed. There's no question. Because let's just say they have an agreement February 10th. Well, you have a lot of players who have to find new homes. You have guys who need visas or come from other countries. So you're not going to get any of that done until – it's going to take at least 2 to 3 weeks before you can you can get these guys to spring training. So now they're arriving in spring training, you know, what's it going to be? Late February, you have to get them. You're going to shorten spring training. But if you don't have an agreement by March 1st, the season will be impacted for sure. Because by the time you get the player signed and the 2 weeks, now you're starting spring training middle of March. You're not going to do any Grapefruit League games until very end of March. You're going to want at least 2 weeks of Grapefruit League action to get these guys ready. So those are the dates. You know, February 1st, if there's no agreement by then, spring training is delayed. If there's no agreement by, I'll say, you know, February 20th or so, or maybe, you know, maybe 25th, the season will be delayed. There's no – we just have to accept that. And right now they're not talking about the key issues. Maybe, you know, when the clock really starts ticking in the month of January, maybe they could pull this off. But there's a lot of ground to cover. And – I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very real possibility that spring training, at minimum, the spring training will be delayed and maybe the season itself. So hate to be the bearer of bad news, but that is what – that is a very real possibility at this point. I do think we should touch briefly on the coaching staff before we wrap. Let me start that by saying that that in terms of the coaching staff, one of the names you're hearing now, Steve Cohen was enamored with Beltran, the Beltran hire, which, of course, he was the minority owner at the time. I would love to see Carlos Beltran come in as the bench coach. A lot of people say that, why would he do that? Well, to get back in the game, that's why he would do it. You know, it's a bit unfair that Cora's back in the game and also A.J. Hinch. Now, if Beltran's not in the game right now because of wannabe, that's a different thing. But if he's somehow being excluded for some reason when the other two guys who are involved have jobs, that's nonsense. And it would be a way for Carlos to, you know, to get back with the Mets, where I think his heart is at this point. And I think his heart is with the Mets. And if he has to come in as a bench coach, then then so be it. You know, then that would be great to have Carlos back and have him back on the bench. And he could be the manager in grooming, you know. Basically, what do you have? You have Buck for 3 more years. I don't think Buck signs another contract. So why not groom Beltran that way back in the Mets organization? I think that would be great.
I'm open to that. That's all I'll say. I'm agreeable, very agreeable with that, Sam.
Carlos got shafted. What else can I say?
Yeah. You know,
let's think about it. There's a possibility in some alternate universe that we're not even talking about Buck Showalter right now.
If not him, you know. If not him, who else? I think Joey Cora would be an interesting hire in the dugout. Pirates let him go. He has a good resume, long history. He has a ring that he won as coach with the White Sox. So he has a resume behind him, and I think he would work well within the dugout. There's other names, obviously, out there if anybody wants to throw some out.
Are there any names that are being thrown out there for hitting coach? Because, you know, at that point, what says that we can't have Beltran and Joey Cora in the dugout? Somehow, some way.
Nothing says you can't have that. But insofar as hitting coach, I'm more preoccupied the narrative that the Mets left off with, which they're not interested in results. They're more interested in the process. That was the problem. Incoming hitting coach. Go for it.
I was just gonna say that the article I read where Chili Davis had something to say, I believe it was with Mike Puma. It sounded like Zach Scott had a lot to do with the way, like, basically Zach Scott being evangelical about the analytical numbers, and Chili Davis basically butting heads with that, and Zach Scott being behind the firing. And not to say that we need to rehire Chili Davis. I'm not saying that. Obviously, this is a whole separate subject. But what I'm saying is that I think with what you're going to, Mike, that might have been specifically a Zach Scott issue, especially because Zach Scott apparently had a lot of background and was hired because of these analytic stuff. And it could be very well that both Sandy Alderson, and let's not discount Sandy Alderson being involved in all of this. It could be both Steve Cohen and Sandy Alderson, who basically partnered at the beginning of this, marrying to Sandy Alderson. Maybe they both learned something over the last year.
Well, that definitely needed to be clarified. You're absolutely right about that. We're talking about different regimes now. And that's why I keep the onus on Billy Epler. He's the architect now. So he's building. So let's see how they build this. You know, he can only be judged in hindsight at this point. He still has work to do. We have nothing to judge him by other than, you know, this offseason, what's transpired so far. Anything else, guys? Going once? Going twice.
Just Hodges. Gil Hodges in the Hall of Fame. Beautiful thing. Probably a Hodges day next year at some point. And since we haven't been on air since, pass it around.
Let's go Mets. Gil Hodges is finally in. We did talk about it, Sam. We cried, remember? Rich?
Oh, my God. So the last podcast we talked about it on this one?
Yes, we did.
With Saperano and Ibby?
That is correct.
Well, I don't think we had Rich on that podcast, so let's hear from himself.
Rich, that number 14 has been up our entire life.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it now?
I think it's great that his number was retired. I think, when you look at it, the numbers seem to say, I mean, the numbers for him, I don't think they're overwhelmingly conclusive that he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but they certainly didn't say that he did not belong in the Hall of Fame. I think it was hard to make, I think that's why the committee struggled with him for all these years, because the numbers were there, but they weren't overwhelming. It's kind of like, not to the same degree, but kind of like Keith Hernandez, who has very, very solid numbers. But were they Hall of Fame numbers? Some said yes, some said no. But when you look at Hodges, and I heard this actually, I forgot who said it, but somebody on TV was saying that, you know, Hodges went beyond the numbers. You know, you don't get voted in the Hall of Fame because you're a manager, if you were a player or a manager, right? But if you think about what he did with the Mets as a manager, and then some people were saying you think about some other things that may have factored in, because human beings make these votes. It may have been also that, you know, his war, you know, war hero, all of that, you know, losing time to the war. People may have looked at him and said, you know, when you look at this man as a whole, and look at the aggregate package of who Gil Hodges is, what he did as a player, managing the Mets, what he, you know, did off the field, being a war hero and all of that, that maybe that's why he was elected to the Hall of Fame. They were electing the total package of Gil Hodges, and that helped make his case and push him over the top that his numbers for all these years just quite didn't do. So I don't know how you guys feel about that, but that's an interesting angle.
Yes,
it is indeed.
Mike, I want to tap into that right away, because you mentioned Keith Hernandez, and Keith Hernandez, with his offensive numbers combined with the defensive numbers that can't even be measured the way anybody has ever been able to measure offense, in baseball. Gil Hodges was Keith Hernandez before Keith Hernandez was. And that's another reason why everybody was always just such a champion about this guy. So many people were. It was that you can't quantify it by just the offensive numbers from the way that we've been able to generationally compare. And the way that Pete Alonso, and maybe even, you know, just thinking about it from the ball perspective, mentioned about the way they make these things, the way they make these baseballs, how can we ever generationally compare anymore, even at that point? So, but without going down the rabbit hole, the defense, the offense, he dominated first base, not only defensively, but offensively for an entire decade. Combined with everything you just said, Rich, the man, the managing, the fact that he wasn't even able to collect an entire managerial career in the sense that of what we know, where Buck currently is, knock on wood, that's where I come in. And that's where I will always come in, other than the personal part, is that it's not just – it's the personal part that pushes the obvious stuff to me. And I see where you're saying where they struggled, but that was the problem. And part of that was that there were equitable players at the time. And yet they kept saying, some of these writers would say, we can't put all the Brooklyn Dodgers in. We can't put all the Boys of Summers in. Why can't you? If they all belong in the Hall of Fame, they all belong in the Hall of Fame. Let's look at the big picture. And also, they should have figured out a long time ago that, like, if you die for a ball, that could have taken away one or two runs. And, like, on to you, Mike. I'm preaching the converted at this point.
Well, you know what? I'm just very happy that Joan is still with us and she's able to realize this. I'm thrilled for the family, Irene Gil Jr., but I'm really, really happy for Joan that she was able to finally realize this moment that her husband's going to be enshrined into Cooperstown. Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. That's the most overriding joy I have right now. I celebrated, you know, the baseball aspect of this greatly. And now I'm just so happy that, you know, the family was able to have this experience and have Jones' husband and Gil's children, you know, have them experience this honor bestowed upon, you know, their husband and father. So that's where I am. And I say we just go into our final word, you know. We'll give out our holiday wishes and, as they say, put a bow on this thing and put it under the tree. You want to start, Tim?
Well, first of all, Mike, thank you. I know that it's been, for all of us, a trying time, and I appreciate just the listeners. I appreciate you, Rich. I appreciate you, Mike, and I'm so thankful that you were able to guide us tonight, Mr. LeColant. Everybody needs to be kind to each other. You know, stop trying to tear everybody down. We don't need to be tearing each other down. We need to be propping each other up. And the second that you find a flaw in somebody, you need to figure out, not necessarily how you need to force what you think they need to do on them, but you need to recognize that they are as flawed as you, and that the reason you may be lashing out at them is because you have some hurt yourself. And just take it easy. Calm down. Take it easy. Happy New Year. Let's go Mets.
Rich.
Well, yeah, I'll take a slightly different angle. I think even though it's not Thanksgiving, it's Christmas, I think it's we should be thankful for what we have, because I'll tell you why. Look what's happening around sports. So the NHL is on pause because of COVID. The NFL, I just, you know, as we're having this podcast, I have the TV on watching the football game that'll be played tonight because of COVID. So you have a real problem in this world. You know, you have everything, the COVID stuff going on with the Omicron variant and all of that impacting sports. We're lucky we have this stuff. You know, we're lucky we even though they're impacted, that we have this distraction, and at least we have this much of our of enjoyment available to us. And so with that said, we should be thankful about what's happening with the Mets. You know, they're trying to win. It's, I think a lot of us are still kind of stunned by what's going on. We're basically, these are the New York Mets who just signed Max Scherzer for $43 million a season. I mean, that's hard to process. They just brought in Buck Showalter. They didn't bring in Mickey Callaway or take, you know, Louis Rojas, who had been in the organization, and find an inexpensive manager that way. These are the New York Mets who are opening the wallet to try to give us a championship in the midst of all the craziness in the world. And it's not just COVID, it's all the other crap. You know, let's be thankful we have what we have. Let's be thankful that, you know, we're healthy, that although impacted, sports are going on and giving us a source of entertainment. And, you know, let's just accept the Christmas present for what it is. Eventually there will be a baseball season at some point, delayed or not. And our New York Mets are actually operating like a big market team. So while there's a lot of craziness out there and a lot of stuff that you know, keeps us nervous and keeps us on our toes and all of that, we have some stuff looking up for us too. And we should just, you know, kind of absorb that. So I guess that's a lot of words, but that's my final thought.
Well said, Rich. Sometimes anxiety can get the best of us. Be on the lookout, folks. You know, it sneaks up on you. So always stay vigilant. I'm thankful for our friendship, Sam, Rich, together, and our podcasting adventures. I will simply say, joy to the world and peace on earth. And let's go Mets. Happy holidays, everyone. Peace and joy to Metsville and baseball fans everywhere. We realize, you know, as one TV and radio personality says, this is the fantasy world. When we hang up this phone and end this podcast, we go back into the real world. Rich, great job surmising that. Sam, likewise. So I bid you all a great holiday on behalf of the Metsian podcast. Joy to the world. Good night, all. Let's go, Mets.
Well said, Mike. Good night. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, everybody.
Well said, Mike.
Good night, all.
Let's go, Mets. Good night, everybody. Peace
on
earth. Merry Christmas.